Good evening, everyone. Anybody? Anybody? Good. Oh, good. Yay. Welcome to our fifth and final installment in our series, Who's On First? And you may remember that we went from Who's On First to What's On Second? Third base? I don't know. Last week was on the mound. Anybody remember who was on the mound? Today was on the mound. And tonight we're behind the plate, and tomorrow is behind the plate. And so tonight we're going to be talking about tomorrow and about legacy planning. We're also going to have, that's going to be a relatively brief part of our evening's presentation. There'll be time for questions left over from previous gatherings, and I think that Annie has a few other things to show us about having the conversation. What I would like to start talking about, I handed out a packet of information, various aspects of legacy planning and estate planning, and what I want to say first and foremost is that anything you hear tonight is strictly for information purposes. You should never, ever, ever make any legacy plans or do any estate planning without consulting an attorney and or financial advisor. Please do not listen to me and go run off and change your will. Unless you leave everything to Trinity, in which case that's fine. But yeah, truly, 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 before you do anything that impacts your will or your estate planning, speak to your attorney, speak to your financial advisor, then tell me. That'll be good. The article that's on the top, I know Charles mentioned that he saw it recently. Several of us might have seen it. It was in the most recent newsletter from AARP. But it's called Death Notice Double Cross. And it outlines some of the risks that we run in terms of identity theft or various scams, depending on how much information we put into an obituary. And what I will leave you to read this at your leisure, but what I particularly want to highlight, that paragraph that's in the left-hand column immediately above where it says identity theft, it says, when it's time to write the notice, give the deceased's age, but leave out the birth date, middle name, home address, birthplace, and mother's maiden name. Don't even include the names of family survivors. This last advice will be hard to follow, but otherwise you put family members at risk of scams like these. So it lists several different types of scams, but first and foremost is all of our big fears, is identity theft. It's interesting, they say nearly 800,000 people a year are specifically targeted after death because no one's checking their credit reports. Which makes sense. Now, I realize that that left-hand column, we shaved off some first letters, so I want to read the next few sentences just to make sure you recognize, because a couple of them lost more than one letter. Okay, immediately after that 800,000 thing. With details gleaned from an obit, crooks can often purchase or figure out the person's social security number to fraudulently open credit card accounts, apply for loans, or even file tax returns to collect refunds. The first five digits of a social security number are linked to a time and place of birth. Yeah. So if someone gets some of it, you know, it's kind of like war games. If you get some of the numbers in the code, it's not long before you get the rest of them. So please do take a look at this. Let's see, it says, quickly send requests to each of the major credit reporting bureaus, Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion, to flag the person's account as deceased. This permanently stops new credit from being issued in the person's name. You'll need a certified copy of the death certificate, proof that you are the executor or spouse, or other details about the deceased. And then it also lists other folks to contact. One of the other lists or pieces of paper in the packet that you were given is a section with information. Yeah, I've got here. Yeah, thanks. Information that actually Doug Tuggle had put together, and he had sent along a packet to us, and invited us to go ahead and use whatever information we would like. But it's, I think it's the third one down. It's called When a Loved One Passes. Doug listed out all of the things that need to be done in the event of a death of a loved one. Some of them need to be done sooner rather than later. And for this first part, Part A, he recommends that we put together a team of advisors. He says this team should include the deceased's CPA or accountant, lawyer for consultation if needed, financial advisor, and or family members with these skills. So there are tasks that we need to address when a loved one dies that we don't necessarily all have the skills for. So please, this again, this is a checklist for you to peruse at your leisure. Some of it is very normal things, normal stuff that we might not think of right off the bat in the midst of the shock. Make arrangements for pet care, garden care, and removal of perishables from the kitchen. Makes sense, but we don't often have that on top of our list. So anyway, the all of the tasks that are listed in that AARP article are in these lists and more.
And Doug did a great job. He lists, first of all, his contact information is on the front. And this is kind of a business that he started up, which is helping people go through the process. But what he did do is he listed, where is it? Okay, he's listed like on here, you'll look through and see under Part B, like freeze all your accounts with the credit reporting agencies, and he lists the common ones. And then he also talks about your auto pay stuff, your internet accounts, I mean, all this stuff. It's a lot, but I don't think there's a darn thing he's missed. So again, Doug's email and phone number and the website is there for you if you wanna use him to help you walk through any of this.
Thank you. Okay, another thing that is in here has to do with dying without a will, which is known as dying intestate. And I think we're probably out of the realm of worrying about minor children in here. But if a couple dies intestate and they have minor children, the court will appoint a guardian and a custodian, a guardian for the day-to-day care of the minor children, and a custodian if there is an estate or if there are any assets to be managed. But it's far better should you know somebody who has minor children, it's far better for them to have a will and to specify in the will who they would like the guardian to be. Some states do allow individuals to file a document that signifies or indicates a guardian without having a will. I do not know if California is one of those. It's best just to have a will. In any event, what this talks about, and again, I hope that I'm talking to folks who have wills, because these papers tell you how your estate is divided if you die without a will. And it goes through all the different scenarios. If you don't have a spouse but you do have kids, if you do have a spouse but you don't have kids, if you've got both, if you've got neither, if you still have living parents, you'll be interested to see how estates get divided when there is no guidance from the deceased. So if you don't have a will, and there are folks in these lists that you have in your family, and you don't want them receiving a portion of your estate, make sure you have a will. Because this paper says at the end, all of this information is academic if you have a will. So this is only pertinent if you do not have a will. The last thing I want to talk about, the AARP thing, that's one page. That's the stapled one. Yeah. You see there's a table on this side, and it's that one, there you go. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so there's, in the order of appearance, you've got the single article, then I think you've got the stapled together information on dying intestate, then you've got the single sheet from Doug Tuggle, and then at the back, you have a beautiful full-color brochure, Planned Giving. Yay! Exactly. And this lovely trifold, And I think Donna Watson had a lot to do with this, and I know Ann Walker and Pat Walker had a lot to do with this. Anyway, the very first, well, again, down at the bottom, the disclaimer, consult your attorney, consult your financial advisor before taking any of our advice. Planned giving at Trinity Episcopal Church. Planned giving is an opportunity for parishioners and supporters of Trinity's ministries to provide long-term support for the parish's mission in the city of Orange and elsewhere. Planned giving is the integration of charitable giving with tax-advantaged estate planning that can occur both during our lifetime and at our death. Plus, planned giving can be structured to allow all levels of income to participate. And just as a bit of more recent history, in the time since I've been here, there are three particular bequests that come to mind. Elizabeth Selman Shipley left Trinity a significant amount of money, and I believe that was right around the time that I arrived. She died shortly thereafter, and so we have some money from the Shipley estate. Eugene Test died back in the 1970s, I think it was. And upon his death, his estate went to his widow, Frances. And Frances died in January of 2012. We were one of the beneficiaries. We were of the remainder estate. And I don't remember what the amount was that we got from the Tests, but it was significant. And it was specifically designated to be used to either pay off the mortgage, of which we didn't have one, or to go into the building fund. So we can thank the Test bequest, I believe, for our front doors and for building projects that continue to be possible because of a decision made back in the 1970s. And so this really does demonstrate how we can plan ahead and how we can have our gifts truly keep on giving in the years to come. The other one, of course, is Richard Burnett. And Richard left us a great deal of money as well upon his death. And so again, we are able to maintain our campus, we are able to further our ministries because of the generosity of folks that we know and remember and loved, and they loved Trinity and left part of their estate to us and to the ministries for the future. So keep that in mind. We may think that we're only planting small seeds, but they really can grow significantly. And on the this opposite facing trifold over here, it talks about different giving vehicles that are very, very interesting. And you can find out about the details of any of them or how they're structured by just Googling them, I'm sure. One of the things that that Trinity has is we do have several endowment funds. And at this point, I would like to invite our treasurer, Jack Reynolds, to come up and talk a little bit about our endowment funds. And then once he's done that, then the last thing I'll tell you about is what happens to money that is given to the church in memory of you. So, again, we hope there's lots. Not that I'm greedy.
Okay, thank you. As Jeannie said, there are three endowment funds that we have at Trinity. We have one that is called General Endowment, and that is basically for new ministries and things like that. We have a Music Endowment, where those funds go to the music program. As far as I know, nothing has ever come out of those two endowments. And then last year, we started a new endowment called Unrestricted Endowment. And what that is designed to keep the principal intact, to spin off the interest and dividends as long as the balance in that account is higher than the cost of living adjusted principal. Interest and dividends would spin out to be used by the vestry for whatever their discretion is on an annual basis. If the vestry doesn't use it, it just stays there and rolls to the next year. A vehicle like that has enabled a parish that I came from to basically support their operations to the tune of about $40,000 a year. Okay, our endowment last year, the general endowment gained approximately $16,000 in gain, and the money was invested ratably over the year, so that's not bad at all. The actual return rate on that money was 10%. The interest spending was about 10% of that, so about $1,600 was available to the vestry. Okay, endowments are not designed to use the principal at all. It's designed to grow. We have two other funds that, if you ever look at the financial statements, you'll see one's called Blake, one's called Collins, and between them they have about $95,000. And those two funds started by two separate gifts, like an endowment gift, one for $6,000 and one for $1,000. And they've gone from $7,000 to $95,000 today, and we have basically taken $12,000 a year out of there for the past 3 years. So the benefit of the endowment is the compounding that you get out of it. Okay? It's not designed as a substitute for your pledge. It's designed for basically like one-time giving, or if you want to plan giving, you plan it that way. Money that's in there has come from stocks. Okay, you may own stocks that have a 50% appreciation. If, in fact, now that they've changed the tax laws, you're in a position to take a charitable deduction, okay, you can basically avoid the tax on the income and take the charitable deduction. Okay, so there are many, very, very many things that you can do to put funds in. But it's really not, it's really geared more for large endowments. Okay, so that this money is, you're looking to use this money 20, 30 years down the road. This is not to be used for current planning. So we happen to be very fortunate enough at Trinity that even though we may have a $20,000 or $25,000 deficit, we have enough of a wherewithal behind us to sustain that for 5, 6, 7, 8 years, okay, as we plan to generate that income. Does anyone have any questions about the endowments? Okay. No, it's a very neat way to help the church, because what you're trying to do is you're basically saying, and I had fight at other churches on this thing, where they get in $25,000 or $30,000 as a bequest, and they say, okay, well, we want to do this with it, we want to spend it on this or spend it on that, and you look back and you say, well, look, what do you think the intent of the person was? Okay, because if you think the intent of the person was to help the parish as a whole, you really want to put that money into an endowment so that the future generations coming to this church can benefit from that money as it grows. And when you get pushed to the wall and you have to use it, it's there that you can actually use it and sustain the parish. So it's a very important vehicle. Yes, sir. Whatever you would care. Well, I don't know if you want to start another one. The unrestricted. I was, when I came here, I only had the two. And the first thing I looked at is that if things get hard at Trinity, there is no vehicle where you can contribute to say, I want the earnings of this to go to support the operating fund of the church. So the unrestricted endowment is really geared not to support the operation of the church, but to allow it to support the operation of the church, because the other two endowments are very restricted. Okay, so this way, if there's funds in there, and usually what happens is those funds will accumulate. Okay, so it will not be surprising if 5 years from now you had maybe $70,000 available to use with the vestry discretion. And it can be used for whatever you want, but it can also be used to supplement the operating fund. Because it's, I'll get in trouble for this, but it's very expensive having two priests, okay? So, I'm sorry. So, when I first came, I thought it was a great thing. It really is a great thing, but you have to provide for it. You have to account what these expenses are going to be, and you don't sit here and look at today, you sit here and look at 2020. What am I going to do in 2020? How am I going to get there? How am I going to have enough funds to do all this support? So that's why I was really, really concerned on developing something like an unrestricted endowment fund. Yes? Up. Yes, that, yeah. Okay, that is not an endowment. It's basically what they call a restricted fund. And if you look at the financial statements, it will give you a list. There's about 25 different funds here that are restricted. Parishioners make donations to that fund, and that is used to subsidize scholarships for the students going to college. Yeah, none of that comes from the operating fund. If you look at the financial statement, and there's one in the church where it has highlights, the bottom part of the highlights show you the restricted funds. Okay, none of those funds are supported by the operating statement of the church, except for the clergy discretionary fund. Okay, basically one loose collection per month is accumulated and given to the fund for the two priests for discretion. But other than that, everything else is free will offering. Dan?
Can you contribute to an existing endowment fund, or if you give something, is that a brand new endowment fund?
Well, it depends on what you're trying to do. First, if the endowment, to set up a new endowment fund, it would have to be approved by the vestry. But you can give to any of the existing endowment funds. The most flexible, again, is the unrestricted endowment, because you're not saying you can only use the earnings from my money for this purpose or that purpose. In order to change the ground rules of the unrestricted endowment fund, you need a 67% vote of the vestry. So there is a clause in there to allow for changing the income distribution calculation. Yes, Rosemary.
A bell put into the tower, something, and the priest and the vestry don't agree with that, can they override what I have done?
No, they should give you your money back. Okay, if you're giving money for a specific restricted purpose, the vestry basically says, yes, we will accept it, or no, we will not accept it. That's what they should do. Now, what they actually do, I'm not, you know, take your pick, but that's what they should do. Okay, they don't have the right to change your restricted gift to something else.
Designated gifts are used for the purpose for which they've been designated. Yeah,
we do not have the power to change the intent of a designated gift. So whether you were to send the check for the bell while you're still with us, or it appeared after you had gone, in the first case, as Jack said, we could say to you, we really don't have a place for a bell, and hand you your check back. Or after your death, if we got the check for the bell, we'd invest it and get the earnings, and that we would not be able to spend it on anything else.
See, the one thing about all the restricted funds is the earnings of those investments, because if you look at the financial statement, you look at the balance sheet, you see there's a big chunk that's actually invested. About $887,000 as of the end of the year is in various and sundry investment forms. All the earnings of that stay within those investment forms. So the earnings don't go back to, let's say, outreach. Maybe outreach starts at the beginning of the year at $10,000 and then dwindles down. Whatever money is earned on outreach, sorry guys, but it doesn't go to outreach. It stays within the general fund. And that's the same for all the other individual restricted funds. Well, once the shrine was there, and I'm sure it'll be lovely, Hal. That if there was extra money, what we would probably then do is go back to your family and say, look, the shrine is there, isn't it lovely? There's like a couple hundred bucks left. Can we use that for other purposes? Okay? You know, we want that residual there to clean the pigeon crap off the statue. So, yeah, there's many different ways to interpret this. The property commission always has a long list. Doug has much more knowledge of the specifics of that than I do. I don't think there is any huge overriding concern of the vestry. I mean, right now the vestry is basically talking about the storage sheds, but I don't think there's any major concern of the vestry for the immediate future. My concern in putting this together was to just develop a fund where you spun off enough income on an annual basis to basically provide for the shortfall as parishioners transition in and out, to be honest with you. Okay, and in my own thinking, we need at least $1 million. Okay, the return on $1 million probably gives you enough insurance that as parishioners, individual parishioners come and go, because, you know, let's face it, giving is a wide range from one parishioner to the next. So if you wind up losing 10% of your major contributors, you're in trouble. Okay, so what this does is basically mitigates that fact. And we're about, what, we're like 20% of the way right now? Yeah, we have a little over 207,000. And it'll slowly grow. But the concept is to provide for the future, not to use it tomorrow. Okay, no other questions on endowments? Thank you.
Thank you, Jack.
Yeah, lots of times folks, the families of folks who have died will say in the service bulletin, in lieu of flowers, donations may be made to whatever. And many times Trinity is among the organizations that is designated to receive memorial gifts. And I just wanted to let you know what happens to that money when it comes into the office. When people give gifts in your memory, we keep track. Amy has a big loose leaf notebook that tracks the gifts that are made in the name of anybody who's deceased. Jack, what's the amount in the memorial fund? In the memorial fund. Yeah, this is the total amount of memorial monies we have at this point in time. Okay, so 15,000 plus. Is money that we still have that has been given to Trinity in memory of several different people, any number of different people. And it's money that has not yet been spent. Sometimes it's been designated, and we've gone ahead and we have followed those directions, or if it's designated for the Altar Guild. That's a fund we will draw on as the Altar Guild needs supplies. We don't ever change the designation if there is a specific purpose that the money is given for. However, if the money is just generally given, what will happen is maybe the Altar Guild does need a new fair linen. And a fair linen ballpark is going to be, let's just say it's $500 or maybe it's $700. And so we might need to look at a couple of the individual funds that are still there. Somebody might still have $35 left in their memory. Somebody else might have $250 left in their memory. We never spend memorial money without contacting the family and saying, this is what we would like to do with it. Is that okay with you? And so we might phone up somebody and say, we have $50 left that was given in Jane's memory. Is it okay if we roll that into an amount that we're going to purchase new fair linen for the altar? And so we can't use that money without their consent. So anybody whose money was going to go towards the new fair linen, we would contact them and get their permission. There are some situations where there are no surviving family members left. I think we only maybe one or two situations like that. And so those we would use our discretion for. They're very small amounts, and we would piggyback them on something else to for whatever we needed. But generally speaking, that's what happens. People who give donations in your memory receive thank you notes from the office. And your family is notified about the gifts that have been received. And as I say, funds are kept until the family decides what to do. Now, for example, the new trees that we have outside the front, those were given in memory of Bernie's mom, Barbara Bobbitt's memory. And what happened was Bernie came and said, I'd like to do something in memory of my mom. What do you got? We said, we'd like to plant some new trees. He said, okay, I'll give money for trees. And we said, how much money for trees? he said, how about $400? So that money was used to purchase the two new trees. It's usually not quite as verbal as that in terms of the arrangement, but that was what the family decided they wanted to do. And also the memorial items that are purchased, we do have a book at the front of the church in under the glass cover, and we do record the memorial items that are purchased with gifts there. And there are times, if it's appropriate, there are times when we do put up a plaque, depending on what it is. The blinds in the nave, for example, were given in memory of Nick and Jenny Greco, and so there's a plaque by the back door that talks about the blinds being given to the glory of God in memory of Nick and Jenny. So that's what happens when money comes in to honor your memory. Any questions about that process? Everything is kept track of. You know, we keep account of everything. We never use money for anything other than what it's designated, unless there is no designation, and then we get the family's permission. So it's in good hands. Okay, your turn.
Another example was Diane Vasquez, her family didn't come here, but she brought her grandchildren to Vacation Bible School. So the money that was given in her honor, her daughter said, just use it all for Vacation Bible School. So for the last couple of Vacation Bible Schools, we've been able to supply everything out of the fund in Diane's honor, because her littles loved coming to VBS. So that's another example. Okay, so now, Anne, would you come on up here? A couple people had said to me the last week and the week before, asking me medical questions. And I said, we'll get to that. And so Anne is one of our parish nurses. And so any question you have, Anne will do her best to answer. I guess the disclaimer is run it by your doctor too. But for instance, one person who's not here tonight wanted to know, what does it mean to be intubated?
Intubated. Okay, there are several ways that you receive oxygenation, and the main way is when we inspire air, you know, just normally. When you can't breathe for yourself, there is a term that is called intubation, where the doctors or a paramedic can put a tube that goes down into your lungs, down into your bronchus, and down into your lungs. And so then people can then give you oxygen via that tube, and they can assist your breathing with a mechanical device or with a respirator, whatever it takes to keep you alive. Does that answer your question? Yes?
Forget it. Yikes. What's the difference between that and just getting oxygen, like the little oxygen mask or in your nose?
Okay. If the paramedics or the doctor or nurses want to give you supplemental oxygen just to help raise your oxygen level, they can do it by putting a nasal cannula into your nose and give you oxygen that way. They can also do it through a mask, and there are lots of different types of masks that can be used. Judy. There have been lots of cases where they have kept people intubated for much longer than that. Yeah, they really have. it could be. Ginny, do you want to add? Right. 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 What's that? Oh, okay. Well, what Ginny said is that lots of times for long-term oxygenation, people may require a tracheostomy, where they do a hole in your neck that goes into your bronchus, and they can put a tube in and have you breathe that way. And yes. Yes, and there are people that are walking around that have tracheostomies. Yeah. Any other medical questions? Yes, you can. Yes. Yes, definitely, but that's where it gets into the specifics that you desire about how you would like to. Yes, as you fill everything out. Yes. What was the question? Oh. Well, you know what? I am not. Okay. Heidi said, if you donate your body to science and they use certain parts of your body, what do they do with the rest of it? And I would think, I honestly don't know the answer to that.
When I was looking into that, there's a couple of things. Either... if you want, your body can be returned to your family as is, and they arrange for the cremation, or it can be cremated and returned to your family if you wish. And if you don't wish that, I don't know what the answer is. I've forgotten. Rocky, you know? Right. No, there's nothing. There's no charges to the family. If you donate your whole body to science, everybody else's, all the costs are covered. Did you want to say something, Carolyn? There's nothing left. Okay. Okay. Oh. Okay, Carolyn shared that at the end of the donated body's use in education or research, that facility would cremate it, and then they had a memorial service for all those who donated. So everything I remember reading about it, it's not like the stupid TV shows or the movies where interns do weird things. It is your loved one's remains are treated with great respect. And it's valuable, really valuable for education. Yeah, Lisa? Okay. Most of us go like to yoga or take painting.
Well,
It's safe, yeah. Thank you.
At the memorial, the students that had worked on your particular, they were there for the memorial and spent time with us. And
Carolyn was sharing, because Phil's body was donated to science. Is that right? Phil's body was donated to science. And Carolyn was sharing that the actual students that worked on his body and used his body to learn were at the memorial service to express their thank yous, their gratitude. So, you know, it's a great opportunity, you know, if you can do that. Anyone else have a medical-related question for Anne?
I think that Heidi's question was really, really good, because I honestly didn't know what happened with what was left. I knew that most of it was used, and I'm sure Anne Warburton, as Ginny and Lisa can attest to, we've all been on those autopsies, and everything is conducted with the utmost respect for someone that is there.
Yeah, Jenny? Jenny shared that at the facility she trained at, they did not do a cremation, but they had a memorial garden. They buried the remains. Okay. Any other questions about any other topics?
Rosemary has changed her mind. She no longer wants to give a bell for the tower. Since Rosemary is the reason that we have incense at the Easter Vigil, and that's the only time all year we have incense, she's giving all her money for incense.
So what I'm going to do is I'm going to pull up my the computer and spend about 5 minutes showing you an additional site that will help you get ready to have the conversations, right? So last week we had the gal from Hoag who talked a little bit about how to have the conversation. This and what the information she used was from this place called the Conversation Project. And the website is on one of the pink sheets. Oh, by the way, copies of everything if you lost anything. But the Conversation Project has three options, one for you, one for your proxy, who will be making decisions for you, and then the third one is for your conversation with your doctor. Okay, and so I'm going to walk you through the one for your doctor, just so you can see, because I liked, it's like if we had, what was her name, Anne? Cordulia. Okay, if we had Cordulia next to us, you know, coming out with these different ideas and helping you and your loved one have the conversation, that'd be great, but we don't. So this conversation project goes through it all. And what it also does is it has, you'll see, places for you to write some notes, do it on a scale, and then reread everything and go, oh, huh, that's what I said? I don't think I agree with what I said, but, you know, so it's really good. So I'm going to bring that up right now. Okay. Oopsie. Okay. I'm not going online because we're having a little issue with a bit of our internet, but let's see. Okay. Okay, I'm done. No. Okay, this is a conversation project. How to talk to your doctor with end-of-life care, and it's with a nurse or whatever your healthcare provider is. And here's the conversation project. It's basically dedicate. The whole program is dedicated to help you have these conversations. There is a starter kit that you can download. And if any of you can't do that or you can't go online and you want me to make a photocopy of this, please get in touch with me. Okay, so things like, okay, so you're ready. And a lot of this, some of this is repeated from what Cordula said. But first of all, you're going to have to explain where you stand and what your future might hold. And you get that information from your doctor. And then it's to start telling them what your preferences are. Because even though you might fill out this form and it's in a file, if you make an appointment to have a conversation, it's just much more vivid and they will remember. So then, and this is interesting. If you're doing Medicare Part B, your voluntary advanced care planning is part of your yearly wellness visit. So they have to give you that time. Okay, so here's options. You know, for some of us, we just think we have a primary care doctor, but if we're having a conversation with a relative who already has a condition, they may have a specialist or a case manager, and also, or if they're in a nursing facility, or if they're seeing someone for mental health, you might want to involve that person as well. Now, this is really good. What's the good time to talk? Well, probably not when you have your five-minute appointment for your flu shot, okay? So you look through that. And then even if you're in good health, great, perfect time. As Cordula said, it's always too soon until it's too late. So here's what I wanted you guys to start thinking about. We've gone through a lot of this, you know, to know some of the medical terms, and you did get a handout on a lot of the terminology, particularly for end-of-life care. And here's some more, like we talked about with Anne. Okay, so then here it's good. You know, we're ready to go. So you know you've got the people you want to talk to, you make an appointment, and you can email or have a conversation, and it tells you exactly what to say. I want to have a conversation about my wishes for end-of-life care. Can I talk to you on Friday? Or I've heard about this program. This is what I've thought of, and I would really like to talk to you. And then this is what's important. My sister died recently, and this is what happened to her, and from that, this is what I learned. Okay, and there's just some different anecdotes here, like this one. I want you to do what you need to do so I can get to my granddaughter's wedding. It's in 1 year. Right? So these are all just anecdotal things. And then it's this. So it even gives you what's your opening line. And then some really important questions to ask for you or your loved ones. You know, okay, so I have this. What's going to happen to my ability to function independently? What should my family be prepared for? You know, if I choose this treatment, what's going to happen and what's the other treatment? And what, I think this one's interesting too. What if I decide I don't want to do anything? And so you get the real details from the doctor who is not going to tell you all that as they're in their mindset because they don't know you want to have that conversation. So this is also good. Ask a lot of questions. I don't understand. Can you explain it in a different way? I want my friend here. Can this be written down? And you can ask for statistics, private conversations, however you want. And then it says, you know, okay, what if it doesn't go as planned? And your healthcare provider doesn't want to talk about it. Will you insist on it? And if you have to, you are entitled to schedule an appointment that focuses specifically on these questions. And, you know, if the person just keeps resisting you, You might need to talk to someone else on the team or the office manager and see what you can do. Also, dementia patients. You can, there is a conversation kit for people with loved ones with Alzheimer's disease or dementia. And so it's on their website. So if you are working with someone who you think is starting to have issues with dementia, it walks you through how to have the conversation, because that's a little tricky when your loved one is beginning to be aware that they aren't as aware, right? But they still want to be autonomous and independent. So that conversation kit has great wording in it. Okay, then it talks about healthcare proxies, which is the person who's going to speak for you if you can't speak, and that person should come with you to your doctor's appointment. There is a conversation project to pick a healthcare proxy, and it's interesting. There's all these little anecdotal stories in the kit, and one of it is a woman talked to her son, and he said, "All right, Mom, I hear you. You don't want anything done. Fine." And that was a little cold. Then she talked to her husband, who said, "I will be at your bedside and hold your hand for as long as all the machines can keep you alive." So he wasn't listening to her. And finally, a daughter said, "Okay, wait a minute, Mama. I hear what you're saying, that you want to have you want some care and not another, that you're writing this down. I can be strong enough, Mom, to make that happen." So your logical person may not be your healthcare proxy. And they tell about, they have a little story about at a gathering like this, some people were sitting at the same table and they looked at each other and they said, "Well, should we be each other's healthcare proxies?" Because it was, they knew each other and they trusted each other, but they could be neutral in supporting the decision making. So something to think about. Okay, then this is interesting. Your doctor doesn't agree with your choices and has his own strong opinion. And this is where you get to, because you made an appointment for a conversation, you can say, "Doc, what are you afraid of? That this aggressive therapy will or won't buy me time? Or is there a therapy that you think will be better for me, but you don't know what's better for me?" And so you want to be able to have that dialogue and to really question why someone's pushing something or not offering at all. And you can get different opinions. And so that is the conversation project on with your doctor. And here's the one with a healthcare proxy. And a lot of it is repeated, and a lot of it will look really familiar to you. So it's the power of attorney for healthcare is what a proxy is. And they will make sure your advance directive or your five wishes is comes true. So again, this is a lot of repeat of what we've already talked about. So here, choosing the right woman. A young woman was diagnosed and with something, and she asked her mom to be the proxy, but she realized it would be too painful for her mother to be able to, even if her mother, because the proxy does what you say, even if they disagree, right? And so your children may not be strong enough to say to the doctor, when they're saying, like Carolyn asked, you didn't want to be intubated, and you are. And so the proxy has to go in and say, "Pull that out." And your child may not be able to. So that's why it's really good to think. Can they stand up for you? Can they ask for clarification? Are they good at making decisions quickly? So maybe you never thought about what you would want to do if you had temporarily had a feeding tube or temporarily had oxygen, but when you wrote up your best wishes, you said no, but now maybe things have changed. So And here's the, so again, it gives you choices. And then this is what I like is, you know, it walks you through every single thing you might be thinking of. You tell your family, you, because you don't want the one person you decided who's going to fulfill your wishes, because they're really strong and neutral, to be having a big blowout fight with your kids who didn't know that you picked someone other than them, right? So then here's the who can't be your proxy, and we went over that and how you can change it. Okay, so you prepare your proxy by saying, you know, I trust you, and I want you to be this proxy. I want you to be the one who makes medical decisions for me if I'm unable to make them myself, and I'm going to tell you what my values and goals are, so you're not going to have to guess. What do you think? Will you talk to me about it? Right? And then they get to understand their responsibilities, which are all on all the forms we've given you, and then they get to understand your wishes. And then here, they have to have a copy of everything. They need to know all the contact numbers of all your healthcare providers, your relatives. And they, you know, if in the middle of having that conversation you're getting any pushback from your choice, then maybe that's not the right proxy, all right? And then the most important thing that they need to keep in mind, they need to know as they make decisions for you, like the questions here. The most important thing for me is to be able to recognize my children, right? So then that would mean something about whether or not you would have to be able to be conscious, right? So maybe it's a sedation issue. Or being in the hospital with excellent nursing care, or I want to say goodbye to the ones I love. So, you know, if whatever it is, your most important thing, because then they get to decide what to do for you if it might be outside of your details, if it's not going to make your most important thing happen, right? Okay, and then it gives you stuff on how to be a good healthcare proxy and a checklist. So, and then this is really interesting. This is the proxy card that you can give to your healthcare provider. So that's the healthcare proxy. Then this one is the conversation project, and what which is really similar to what we heard from Best Wishes and from the original packet we gave you and from Cordula. Oopsie, let's go to the very top. Because there's these, there's this, a format here that I like. Okay, so. All right. Okay, so you get to write in here, what matters to me at the end of my life is, and you fill it out. Then, okay, then we start to go where you are on scales. So as a patient, I'd like to, one, only know the basics, and five, know all the details. So, you know, you got to pick. And as a team, I want them to do what the doctors think is best, or I want to say in every decision, right? And then terminal illness. Do I want to know if I'm progressing, or do I want them to figure out and maybe not tell me I'm getting close to death? And then you look at your answers. You know, like, what kind of role do you want to have? And you may have, from the scale, realized, oh, I don't want to know any of the details, but I said I wanted to be conscious and making decisions when I wrote it out. So it helps you catch your conflicts, right? And again, it goes down again. So it's just one more thing, one more set of questions, because Cordula didn't go over exact things. She gave us a couple of really good things to think about, but this, some of these are really interesting. So about your privacy, sharing information, involvement, and then you again get to restate what are the most important things that you want everyone to understand. And then again, who do you have the conversation with, and what do you want them to know? And then I love this. Here's some icebreakers. You know, I need your help with something. Remember when Uncle so-and-so died? Was it a good death or a hard death? What do you, I was thinking about what happened to Uncle so-and-so, and it made me realize I need to talk about my concerns. I'm okay right now, but I want to be prepared, so will you help me with this? And then it goes through all the things that you would want to discuss with your loved ones. Like Cordula said, at home, nursing, hospital, what do you want, what don't you want? And then it gives you some tips on being patient during your conversation, because the people you talk to may completely disagree with you. And nothing set in stone. Maybe instead of coming forward and laying the five wishes on your kid's desk, you have the conversation, then you may change your mind on some of the things you would write, because you know that your good death also includes taking into consideration your children's wishes, right? So it's one of those, it's a work in progress, not just fill out the form and put it in the file. And then they say, you go back late, you always go back and re-talk about it and ask for if they need any clarification. Do they disagree? What if one kid thinks one way and the other kid thinks the other way? It would be so much better to have the conversation before you're sick, so that when you're sick, it's not World War III between siblings. And then, how does this make you feel? And what do you want if it happened to you? And this is a good way to bring it up to your younger relatives who are still invincible, right? And then what do you want to talk about next time? So this may not be a sit down and, 2 hours later it's completed. It might be piecemeal for as much time as both of you can manage it. So again, I encourage you to go to the Conversation Project, and if it's online, and it's on the top of, Gina, you want to get the lights? It's on the top of the pink sheets. So, and look, that I gave out last week. So the pink sheets from last week have all the websites that you would need. And if any of you guys are online and you start to get frustrated, you can just call me and I'll walk you through it. And if you can't get online or it just drives you bonky and you want a photocopy of those kits, I can print one off for you. So, yeah, Jack. Yes. On the Conversation Project are the Conversation Starter Kit for your family, for your doctor, for your proxy. There's also a Conversation Kit for people with Alzheimer's or dementia, and it's in like 14 or 15 different languages. Okay, and so I've given out two pink sheets throughout this. Is it bad or good?
Oh,
okay. The pink sheets have every source of every piece of information we've handed out throughout this series, and there's one for resources for funerals and burials, and resources for end-of-life conversation and medical directives. And I have multiple copies here. Yeah, Rosemary?
And your proxy says one thing, and your children says another thing. Are the doctors going to go with your proxy, or are they going
to? Okay. That's what, when a healthcare proxy, the other term you might have heard of is the durable power of attorney. That's what you're establishing for your medical care, right? So they have the right, not anybody else. So this is why you have to have a conversation, because if I, if you want one thing and you don't let everybody else know, then it will be it'll be awful. You'll not only will you be sick and in the hospital and dying, but everybody's going to be fighting, right? And Jeannie and I have seen and coached families through, do we take our loved one off of life support or not? And then we have people in the family saying, you can't, you're killing her. No. It's medical intervention that is prolonging the process of dying, right? And the person already said they didn't want that. So you have having the conversation prevents the family fallout, right? Okay. And it is hard, which is why the conversation kit is so good, and you do as much as you can, and then you go back to it, and be prepared. In one of them, that, you know, the first thing you might get is, oh my gosh, you're so morbid, or you're too young to have this conversation, or I don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear it. So then you got to find somebody else to talk to. So, any last questions? If there are no forms filled out, that whoever's stated as your next of kin, I think, if that's your next of kin, I don't know, you'd have to, it would be your spouse if you really are married, because some people claim each other as spouses, but they're not married. They live together as spouses for financial reasons. So then, that's not your next of kin or your decision maker. It's whoever you happen to have down the chain of family line. Anyone else? Okay, Jeannie, do you want to close us? Okay. Let's pray. All right. The Lord be with you. Oh, good and gracious God, we thank you so much for every moment we are on this planet, primarily because we are surrounded by your presence and your love. As we all try to figure out with who and when we will have these tough conversations, help us to know that we are loved and your presence is guiding us, and where we're headed is just glorious. And in the meantime, please bless all of us and those we love, and take us home safely. Amen.